this microwave radiation is not much good for defrosting frozen pizza. But the fact that the spectrum agrees so exactly with that of radiation from a body at 2.7 degrees tells us that the radiation must have come from regions that are opaque to microwaves. Thus, we can conclude that our past light cone must pass through a certain amount of matter as one follows it back. This amount of matter is enough to curve space-time, so that the light rays in our past light cone are bent back toward each other. As one goes back in time, the cross-sections of our past light cone reach a maximum size and begin to get smaller again. Our past is pear-shaped. As one follows our past light cone back still further, the positive energy density of matter causes the light rays to bend toward each other more strongly. The cross-section of the light cone will shrink to zero size in a finite time. This means that all the matter inside our past light cone is trapped in a region whose boundary shrinks to zero. It's therefore not very surprising that Penrose and I could prove that in the mathematical model of general relativity, time must have a beginning in what is called the Big Bang. Similar arguments show that time would have an end when stars or galaxies collapse under their own gravity to form black holes. We had sidestepped Kant's antimony of pure reason by dropping his implicit assumption that time had a meaning independent of the universe. Our paper, proving time had a beginning, won the second prize in the competition sponsored by the Gravity Research Foundation in 1968, and Roger and I shared the princely sum of $300. I don't think the other prize essays of that year have shown much enduring value. There were various reactions to our work. It upset many physicists, but it delighted those religious leaders who believed in an act of creation, for here was scientific proof. Meanwhile, Lifshitz and Kolatnikov were in an awkward position. They couldn't argue with the mathematical theorems that we'd proved, but under the Soviet system, they couldn't admit that they'd been wrong and Western science had been right. However, they saved the situation by finding a more general family of solutions with a singularity, which weren't special in the way their previous solutions had been. This enabled them to claim singularities and the beginning or end of time as a Soviet discovery. Most physicists still instinctively dislike the idea of time having a beginning or end. They therefore pointed out that the mathematical model might be expected not to be a good description of space-time near a singularity. The reason is that general relativity, which describes the gravitational force, is a classical theory, as noted in Chapter 1, and does not incorporate the uncertainty of quantum theory that governs all other forces we know. This inconsistency doesn't matter in most of the universe most of the time, because the scale on which space-time is curved is very large, and the scale on which quantum effects are important is very small. But near a singularity, the two scales would be comparable, and quantum gravitational effects would be important. So what the singularity theorems of Penrose and myself really established is that our classical region of space-time is bounded to the past, and possibly to the future, by regions in which quantum gravity is important. To understand the origin and fate of the universe, we need a quantum theory of gravity, and this will be the subject of most of this book. An important step in the discovery of quantum theory was Max Planck's suggestion in 1900 that light always comes in little packets he called quanta. But while Planck's quantum hypothesis clearly explained observations of the rate of radiation from hot bodies, the full extent of its implications wasn't realized until the mid-1920s, when the German physicist, Werner Heisenberg, formulated his famous uncertainty principle. He noted that Planck's hypothesis implies that the more accurately one tries to measure the position of a particle, the less accurately one can measure its speed, and vice versa. More precisely, he showed that the uncertainty in the position of a particle times the uncertainty in its momentum must always be larger than Planck's constant, which is a quantity that's closely related to the energy content of one quantum of light. The Maxwell field. In 1865, the British physicist James Clerk Maxwell combined all the known laws of electricity and magnetism. Maxwell's theory rests on the existence of fields that transmit actions from one place to another. he recognized that the fields that transmit electric and magnetic disturbances are dynamical entities. They can oscillate and move through space. Maxwell's synthesis of electromagnetism can be condensed into two equations that prescribe the dynamics of these fields. He himself derived the first great conclusion from these equations, that electromagnetic waves of all frequencies travel through space at the same fixed speed, the speed of light. Quantum theories of systems such as atoms with a finite number of particles were formulated in the 1920s by Heisenberg, Schrödinger, and Dirac. Dirac was another previous holder of my chair in Cambridge, but it still wasn't motorized. However, people encountered difficulties when they tried to extend quantum ideas to the Maxwell field, which describes electricity, magnetism, and light. The Maxwell field. In 1865, the British physicist James Clerk Maxwell combined all the known laws of electricity and magnetism. Maxwell's theory rests on the existence of fields that transmit actions from one place to another. He recognized that the fields that transmit electric and magnetic disturbances are dynamical entities. They can oscillate and move through space. Maxwell's synthesis of electromagnetism can be condensed into two equations that prescribe the dynamics of these fields. He himself derived the first great conclusion from these equations, that electromagnetic waves of all frequencies travel through space at the same fixed speed, the speed of light. One can think of the Maxwell field as being made up of waves of different wavelengths, the distance between one wave crest and the next. In a wave, the field will swing from one value to another like a pendulum. According to quantum theory, the ground state, or lowest energy state of a pendulum, is not just sitting at the lowest energy point, pointing straight down. That would have both a definite position and a definite velocity, zero. This would be a violation of the uncertainty principle, which forbids the precise measurement of both position and velocity at the same time. The uncertainty in the position, multiplied by the uncertainty in the momentum, must be greater than a certain quantity, known as Planck's constant, a number that's too long to keep writing down, so we use a symbol for it. So, the ground state, or lowest energy state of a pendulum, does not have zero energy, as one might expect. Instead, even in its ground state, a pendulum or any oscillating system must have a certain minimum amount of what are called zero-point fluctuations. These mean that the pendulum won't necessarily be pointing straight down, but will also have a probability of being found at a small angle to the vertical. Similarly, even in the vacuum or lowest energy state, the waves in the Maxwell field won't be exactly zero, but can have small sizes. The higher the frequency, the number of swings per minute of the pendulum or wave, the higher the energy of the ground state. Calculations of the ground state fluctuations in the Maxwell and electron fields made the apparent mass and charge of the electron infinite, which is not what observations show. However, in the 1940s, the physicists Richard Feynman, Julian Schwinger, and Shinichiro Tomonaga developed a consistent way of removing or subtracting out these infinities and dealing only with the finite observed values of the mass and charge. Nevertheless, the ground state fluctuations still caused small effects that could be measured, and that agreed well with experiment. Similar subtraction schemes for removing infinities worked for the Yang-Mills field in the theory put forward by Chen-Ning Yang and Robert Mills. Yang-Mills theory is an extension of Maxwell theory that describes interactions in two other forces called the weak and strong nuclear forces. However, ground state fluctuations have a much more serious effect in a quantum theory of gravity. Again, each wavelength would have a ground state energy. Since there is no limit to how short the wavelengths of the Maxwell field can be, there are an infinite number of different wavelengths in any region of space-time, and an infinite amount of ground state energy. Because energy density is, like matter, a source of gravity, this infinite energy density ought to mean there is enough gravitational attraction in the universe to curl space-time into a single point, which obviously hasn't happened. One might hope to solve the problem of this seeming contradiction between observation and theory by saying that the ground state fluctuations have no gravitational effect. But this wouldn't work. One can detect the energy of ground state fluctuations by the Casimir effect. If you place a pair of metal plates parallel to each other and close together, the effect of the plates is to reduce slightly the number of wavelengths that fit between the plates relative to the number outside. This means that the energy density of ground state fluctuations between the plates, although still infinite, is less than the energy density outside by a finite amount. This difference in energy density gives rise to a force pulling the plates together, and this force has been observed experimentally. Forces are a source of gravity in general relativity, just as matter is, so it would not be consistent to ignore the gravitational effect of this energy difference. Another possible solution to the problem might be to suppose there was a cosmological constant, such as Einstein introduced, in an attempt to have a static model of the universe. If this constant had an infinite negative value, it could exactly cancel the infinite positive value of the ground state energies in free space. But this cosmological constant seems very ad hoc, and it would have to be tuned to extraordinary accuracy. Fortunately, a totally new kind of symmetry was discovered in the 1970s that provides a natural physical mechanism to cancel the infinities arising from ground state fluctuations. Supersymmetry is a feature of our modern mathematical models that can be described in various ways. One way is to say that space-time has extra dimensions, besides the dimensions we experience. These are called Grassmann dimensions because they're measured in numbers known as Grassmann variables rather than in ordinary real numbers. Ordinary numbers commute, that is, it doesn't matter in which order you multiply them. 6 times 4 is the same as 4 times 6. But Grassmann variables anti-commute. X times Y is the same as negative Y times X.